So to move on to tonight's debate, as I said, it's this House would compensate the descendants of slaves, and the speakers we have, we have some very, very eminent speakers, so we've got very long and complicated biographies for them. In proposition, we have Professor Robin Blackburn, who is currently Distinguished Visiting Professor of Historical Studies at the New School for Social Research in New York. And he's Professor of Sociology at Essex University. He's written widely about the history of slavery in the New World, the economic legacies of slavery, and the contribution of slavery to the British economy. Two books he's written, perhaps most famously, The Overthrow of Colonial Slavery, and most relevant to the debate, The Making of New World Slavery. We are very grateful to him for giving up his evening, and we'd like to thank him for coming. Next to him, we have Esther Stanford. She's a jurisconsult and a committed campaigner for slavery reparations. She's secretary of the Rendezvous of Victory campaign group and has appeared on Radio 4's The Today programme to discuss compensating the descendants of the transatlantic slave trade. And we are equally grateful to her for giving her time this evening to talk to us. In opposition, we have Dr. Brooke Carey. He's a reader in English literature at Kingston University. He's the author of many books and journals concerned with discussing slavery and abolition. Most recently, he's edited a special edition of the Journal for 18th Century Studies entitled Slavery and Anti-Slavery. He's appeared on BBC World News and Radio 4 to discuss slavery and the anti-slavery movement. And again, we're equally delighted to see him give up his time for us this evening. Last, but by no means least, we have Fern Brennan. She's a senior lecturer in the School of Law, University of Essex. Her current research interests focus on institutional racism and the law. She provides race equality, law consultancy and training to Westminster Briefing, the Home Office, and has worked at the National Centre for Social Research on Immigration Decision-Making in the light of the Race Relations Act 1976. She's written several papers on the question of reparations for trading in slavery and issues concerning racial and religious hate crimes and EU race equality law. She's also organising hosting a conference entitled Colonialism, Slavery, Reparations and Trade at SOAS on the 10th of November.
This year.
All ULU students are warmly invited to attend all ULU students are welcome to attend. Aims to explore the links between economic underperformance, colonial history, slavery and institutional racism. If you'd like to find out more, you can ask her after the debate or go to www.essex.ac.uk/reparations to find out more and to register for the conference. So we're equally delighted to see her here this evening. So thank you very much. The format for tonight is the same as always, 7-minute speeches on either side before a floor debate and then summary speeches. Each member of the floor panel has 7 minutes to make their case, the first and last minutes of which are protected. In the middle 5 minutes, you may offer a point of information by standing and raising your hand and saying point of information. It is up to the speaker to accept that or not, so if you are accepted, please make your point quickly in about 10 seconds. If not, just please sit down and don't cause a fuss, because we don't like fuss. Floor speeches after the four main speeches are 3 minutes in length, and there is a box of chocolates available for the best one, so please get your points ready before we do that. So without much further ado, I'd like to introduce Professor Robin Blackburn to open the case for the proposition.
Well, my starting point is going to be that the Atlantic slave trade and the systems of slavery that were created as a result of that trade in the Americas from the 16th century to the 19th century, that they were together and in several and different ways a great crime against humanity, a crime against Africa, and a crime against the slaves and the descendants of slaves in the New World itself. I'm going to be arguing, and we are going to be arguing, I'm going to look at the historical side of things. My very able colleague will be looking at some of the more contemporary and legal issues. We're going to be arguing that what is needed is compensation for Africa, which had 12 million young people torn from it at the time when they were at the height of their productive powers. Also compensation for the descendants of slavery in the Americas who've suffered racial oppression and discrimination, which has its roots in at least to a major extent, in that slave system and the slave experience, and who've been disadvantaged by whole communities disadvantaged by that experience. The compensation we're going to be asking for, obviously, because this is a case of a historical injustice, we can't actually compensate the most direct victims. We can't compensate those who died, which were maybe 3 million or more on the Atlantic slave trade, or marching to the coast, maybe another 3 million. We can't compensate those American slaves, obviously, who are dead. The compensation we can offer, however, is to their descendants, whether they be in Africa or in the New World. And that compensation, I don't think it should be exclusively economic, but I do think that it would be very strange if it didn't have a pretty strong economic component, because the loss to Africa, the loss to the descendants of slavery in the New World, has been an economic loss. And I think treating it as, in part, an economic injury, but it's by surely much more than just an economic injury, but to sort of say, well, it's some higher species of injury for which actually we don't have to pay a penny, I think that would be a suspect line of argument, and it's one that we would oppose. So we mean compensation in the broadest sense, including economic compensation, but not limited to economic compensation. Just want to say a little bit more about the history of the slave trade and slavery. That Africa suffered, I think, is undeniable. And one can specify this further by saying that the 12 million taken from Africa were young people. Two-thirds of them young men, one-third young women, aged roughly 12 to 20. So they were people who'd been produced at the cost and who represented the hope and future of African societies. Quite a lot of them, quite small-scale societies, and many of them were destroyed by the impact of the slave trade. The other thing which was very unfortunate is that the slave trade created a logic in Africa itself of assisting the most predatory social formations and empires. They became slave raiders on behalf of the Atlantic slave trade. And they were the ones who got to import British, European firearms, British, European metalware and swords and spears and so forth. So we armed the most predatory. Lots of African societies didn't want to participate in the slave trade, but we armed the ones who did want to participate in it. And they had the edge of having the modern weapons that they were supplied with. Used to be something like 200,000 guns a year that would be traded for slaves, together with many other trade goods on the African coast. Then I want to mention that, ask the question, I mean, why is it down to us to do the compensating? Well, the us that I'm talking about here is more generically the West, but specifically we're talking here in London, I'm talking about the British. The British actually conveyed nearly 4 million of the those who were taken from Africa by the slave trade. We had huge, hugely important slave plantations in the Caribbean, in the North American colonies, and we did a lot of trade with other colonial and slave planting powers. Yeah.
Do you expect the Arab world as well to compensate Africa for slave trade, which lasted far longer than the European slave trade in Africa?
I would be perfectly prepared to accept that. I should say to you that, of course, in any one year, the Arab trade was much smaller than the European trade. The European trade is concentrated in 4 centuries. The Arab one stretches over 1,000 years. But actually, the Middle East is a pretty prosperous part of the world. There is, however, an added argument in the case of the European and, above all, British slave trade, which is that there's no evidence that slavery in the Middle East really transformed those societies, or that they benefited so much from the profits of slavery that, you know, that there was a plantation system, but it actually got destroyed by a big slave revolt, the Zand Revolt in the 8th century. Whereas, although there were great revolts in the Americas, there was also a hugely profitable trade and hugely profitable plantations. And in my book, The Making of New World Slavery, but also Ken Pomerantz in a recent book, and really I would say the balance of scholarly opinion and research is that that was a vital support to British prosperity. So it's down to us to come up with appropriate forms of compensation. In a year around 1770, I'm able to show that about a half of gross British capital formation did come from trade with the plantations and the colonies and with Africa. So I just want to conclude by saying I'm not making an appeal here to hereditary guilt. I think hereditary guilt is basically a bad idea. But hereditary privilege, yes, that does exist. And I think many of us in Britain are beneficiaries of hereditary privilege. Simply the life chances we've had, the education that we and perhaps now you are receiving, I think that that gives us just that much better start in life. And it's through no virtue of our own, just the accident of having been born here. So I think we should look at this programme of compensation.
I'd like to thank Professor Blackburn for his fine speech, and we move to now to the opposition, and we look to Fern Brennan to open the case for the opposition.
I wish to oppose the proposal for compensation for descendants of the transatlantic slave trade. Am I? You want me to stand up? Oh, sorry. Didn't realise. Okay, let's start again. I wish to oppose the proposal for compensation for descendants of the transatlantic slave trade by way of an alternative mechanism. It's not exactly a complete denial of the claims that the first speaker has made, but I want to look at it in a slightly different way. As I said, that mechanism, this alternative mechanism, is to use the reparations framework that was originally put forward by Professor Theo van Boven when he looked at ways in which to provide remedies for crimes against humanity. And my argument is that what a reparations framework could do is to regulate the current international trade rules and impacts on ex-slaves, ex-colonial African and Caribbean economies in terms of the production and sale of their products, such as sugar, bananas, rice, flour, and so on, for Western markets. Now, whilst I understand the sentiment that has been put forward with respect to compensation, as a lawyer, I can see insurmountable problems in the launch of a claim for compensation. As soon as lawyers hear the word compensation, they straight away go to what mechanism would deliver this compensation, and you would tend to look at the legal system as it is currently formed. There are a number of problems with the legal system that we have. We can't invent a mechanism. This is what we have. One would be, who are the victims? Who would bring a claim? If you're going to bring a claim for compensation in the courts, you must have a complainant. Who would that be? How would you establish the relevant class of descendants? And I think that that's a very, very big issue. The second issue, of course, is who is going to be the respondent? Against whom would the claim be brought? Slave owners have died. Profiteers, they've also died. And, of course, on what grounds would you make these groups, if you could find them, responsible? Some would argue the state should pay. I mean, in other words, taxpayers. And I think that that kind of argument might be not very palatable. And it seems to me, if we look at what's happened in the states, where they've tried to litigate, they've had problems. What you see is a gravy train for lawyers in reality, and I just wouldn't welcome that. The other thing, of course, we need to consider when we're looking at litigation and compensation is harm. What harm are we talking about? Now, Lord Gifford called the African Holocaust, as I would agree, a number of American scholars certainly talk about that, as a crime against humanity. The World Conference Against Racism also upholds this view. And it states that This not only was the African Holocaust a crime against humanity, but it should always have been so. And one of the difficulties, of course, is that there are arguments about trying to call something an ancient wrong when it wasn't seen as a wrong at the time. It wasn't seen as a legal wrong, at least at the time. The fact remains that under the rules on causation, in law at least, one has to establish a link between past harms and current injury. What is the current injury? Some people have argued that what you have are a number of well-heeled black well-heeled people who just want more money for themselves, and in actual fact it's not actually going to make a difference to people, poor people in Africa or indeed in the Caribbean. So we have to be careful. Is the current injury racial discrimination? That's certainly an argument to think about. How do we link ancient harms with this current claim, that of racial discrimination? There is another problem. We talk about ancient harms as the legal harm. Some have argued that we would identify as a legal harm now was not a legal harm at the time. I don't necessarily subscribe to that, but that's certainly the argument that's made. And so on. So, compensation, again, is a problem. I hear the proponent saying that when we're talking about compensation, we're also talking about money. And I have a real difficulty with that. Where is this money going to go to? Where is it going to come from, and where is it going to go to, and who's going to distribute it? If we look at, for example, the Jewish Holocaust, and the way in which the Claims Conference in New York distributes money, there's a group that decides who gets the money. And I don't think that that's the kind of route, my personal view, that's not the kind of route that we should be taking. What kind of measure?
There was an article, I think about 10 years ago, from a black man in America who said something to the effect that he was happy that his ancestors had brought over because it gave him the opportunity to grow up in America, where he had far more opportunity than he would have remained in Africa. Do you in any way subscribe to that theory?
Not really, no. And I'd have to have far more detail, but I don't think I do. I think that does assume that Africa is backward and would always have been backward, and America has afforded this person opportunities. If we look at the history of America, I'm not sure I would agree with that at all. Nevertheless, I believe there is a way to address the call for compensation for the slave trade. We have got to address this. It is not going to go away. And what I think we should be looking at and addressing is the contemporary and continuing legacy of slavery. I should say, when I say slavery, I mean the slave trade. What is the legacy? I think the legacy is institutional racism. I think Macpherson, when he looked at the way in which services were operating and mechanisms were operating in his country, and this is something that you could take elsewhere, was absolutely right in saying that we have systems in place that we've inherited that are unwittingly and unconsciously practices of racism. And I think that if you look at the current trading, international trading regime that we have globally, we can see that this inequality that people in the Caribbean and Africa have with respect to things such as sugar in the Caribbean, flowers, and so on, tell us quite clearly that there are problems for those people who try to trade with the West. It seems to me that what we need is some kind of reparations framework. That reparations framework would subject international trading rules to its scrutiny. And the conference that we're looking at, which is, you know, the devil's in the detail, the conference is actually going to look at what that reparations framework would be. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Fern for her fine speech. And for the last speech on the property, before we move to the floor speeches, I would like to invite Esther Sanford to take the floor.
Okay, speaking in favour of the proposition that this House would compensate the descendant of slaves, I would prefer to say enslaved Africans, of which I am one, I'd first of all like to start by saying that the struggle for compensation actually is one of the most important struggles being waged in the world today. For it is about fundamental issues of human freedom, human justice, and the value we place on human life in the past as well as in the present and future. But this struggle, like all our other struggles, begins with the need for a clear conception of what we want, how we define the issue and explain it to the world, and what is to be done to achieve it. Therefore, we are building an international reparations theory that encompasses financial compensation, and we call this Pan-African Reparations for Global Justice. Compensation is not just about the past abuse itself of slavery. In fact, we are talking about compensation for the contemporary effects of these past violations, massive violations of human and people's rights. Furthermore, international Eurocentric law, as it currently stands, also recognises that when crimes against humanity have been committed, the perpetrators and successors who still profit from the crime should make reparations, including financial compensation to the victims and their descendants who still suffer from the consequences of these crimes. According to the 1993 Abuja Proclamation, which was issued at the first Pan-African Reparations Conference in Nigeria, the damage sustained by the African peoples is not a thing of the past, but is painfully manifested in the damaged economies of the black world, from Guyana to Guinea, from Somalia to Suriname, and in the damaged lives of contemporary Africans from Harlem to Harare. So this question of compensation is one that British law actually does recognise, because in 1833, after the Abolition of Slavery Act, in fact, so-called slave owners received compensation at the time of £20 million for so-called loss of their property in the enslaved Africans. So compensation is something that is well established in international law. And why should we, the descendants of the enslaved, be... Yes?
If compensation is issued, what do you think that will do for the progress we've had in interracial and intercountry relations?
Okay, well, progress is a matter of opinion. Actually, speaking of someone who is still very much dispossessed from my land, my heritage, my identity, and my inheritance, as are many other African descendants, I think the question of progress is open to debate. Compensation, what will it include? A long-term commitment to financing, resourcing, and supporting all the efforts of African people and our allies to make repairs of the damage. I'm sorry, I'm not going to take that point of information at the moment. Restitution of the value of unjust enrichment based upon so-called slave and colonial labour, as well as expropriations of lands, minerals and raw materials to the West. Damages for physical or mental harm, including pain, suffering or emotional distress. Just visit your local psychiatric institution and see the damaged lives of African descendants living right here in Britain. Damages for lost opportunities, including proper education, employment, recreation and leisure. Material damages for loss of earnings in terms of us being deprived of our just inheritance as heirs. Also funds for scholarship, yes?
Do you impart any blame on the African states which are the successors who sold their own slavery, and should they give compensation as well?
Well, actually, we're dealing with the European case. In every group of oppressed people, you will always have collaborators. No one morally sensitive blames Jewish collaborators for the Jewish Holocaust. That is a red herring, and I don't wish to pursue it any further. We're talking about funds for scholarships and community development, damages for harm to our reputation and our dignity. As African descendants, our dignity is still insulted today. We are still not treated as equal human beings because we still have the interference of Western nations trying to define for us what our humanity should be, how we should govern our states. So clearly we are still dependent. We're also talking about costs for legal assistance. So the question of financial compensation is not the whole question of reparations, but it is an aspect. Sorry, no more points of information. And I'm now going to just conclude by reading a paragraph from our position paper, that is the Pan-African Reparations Coalition in Europe. Our struggle for reparations is not asking anyone to give us anything or do anything charitable for us. Rather, it is a long overdue demand for what, by all the tenets of justice, is rightfully ours. We are demanding complete economic, political, social, cultural, as well as spiritual justice. That is justice which is true in its holistic meaning. Receiving the financial component of reparations will be meaningful only if it serves the holistic purpose and strengthens the integral whole of our own self-determined self-repair process. Although no sum of money could ever erase our pain or wash away the blood our glorious ancestors shed at the hands of their enslavers, we must have all that is necessary for restoring ourselves and future generations. This is what financial compensation is about, and the whole question of financial compensation has been on the agenda for centuries. In Britain, the first African who raised this call for restitution for the injuries was in 1787, and that is Otobo Kugwana. And it wasn't until 1993 that we had the group of eminent persons under the auspices of the Organization of African Unity take up this cause. And it wasn't until 2001 that 168 governments from around the world acknowledged that slavery was a crime against humanity. The questions must continue, but this is a journey that is only beginning, not ending.
I'd like to thank Esther for her fine speech, and just remind you that after Dr. Rick and Carey's speech, we have the floor debate. You may speak in proposition, opposition, or you may speak in abstention if neither side has persuaded you and you can't make up your mind. Those speeches are 3 minutes in length, with 30 seconds protected at either end, so if you want to be in a chance of winning the box of chocolates, start writing now, and there'll be the chance after the speech. But before that, we do look to Dr. Brick and Carey to continue the case for the opposition.
As we've heard, slavery was a very great evil in the history of the world, a crime against humanity, and great evils should not go unamended. But I find myself, somewhat to my own surprise, arguing against the proposition as it is currently phrased. It is a mistake, I think, to focus our attention on individual descendants of the enslaved, whether as individuals per se or as parts of wider communities. Instead, we should be working to rid the world of poverty, since global poverty is one of the most crippling legacies of European imperialism, of which slavery and the slave trade was just one part. In fact, slavery has been widespread in human history, and probably, if we go back far enough, most of us are the descendants of slaves. For this proposition to be meaningful, then, it would have to define very precisely what kind of slavery is being compensated for, when and where that slavery took place, and who qualifies as a descendant of one of the enslaved. And this is where it gets difficult. The unstated assumption in the proposition is stated by all of the other speakers, is that we should compensate the descendants of those who were enslaved in the Atlantic world between 1492 and about 1880. Although, of course, there were other slave trades and other systems of unfree labour operating in other parts of the world. And I think we'd have to ask very carefully whether or not these are different cases. And even the Atlantic trade was global in its reach, enslaving over the centuries Native Americans, some Europeans, and many Africans, as well as Chinese and Indian indentured servants living in conditions very close to slavery from the 19th century onwards. So how do we establish who is descended from this diverse group and who is not? Well, of course, if you're black and you're born outside of Africa, there is a very strong chance that some of your ancestors Maybe all of your ancestors have been enslaved, but there are also many direct descendants of slaves who would describe themselves as white, Asian, or Native American. And let's not also forget that there are hundreds of millions of people, in Africa particularly, whose ancestors were never enslaved by Europeans, but who have suffered severe poverty, in part, and as we've heard, because of the long-lasting economic effect of the slave trade. This proposition only was compensate the descendants of slaves. So it's impossible to predict on the basis of someone's appearance or geographical location whether they are in whole or in part the descendants of slaves, or the extent to which slavery blighted their personal economic opportunities. For that reason, I cannot support, as it is currently phrased, the proposition that this House should compensate the descendants of slaves. But I say as it is currently phrased because, in fact, I'm very much in sympathy with the view that Atlantic slavery was a great evil in our history, that nations in Western Europe and North America were enriched at the expense of nations in Africa, the Caribbean, and South America, and that those nations that broadly benefited from slavery should accept that they have a moral responsibility to seriously tackle the most enduring and pernicious legacy of slavery, global poverty. Of course, global poverty cannot be ascribed to the legacy of slavery alone. The picture is complex, and the legacy of slavery is only one facet of the toxic relationship between Europe and the rest of the world that saw the resources of Africa, Asia, and much of the Americas diverted into the pockets of a few disproportionately wealthy nations. European empires had many victims, not only the enslaved, and we cannot hope to separate the earlier legacies of slavery either from the later legacies of empire or from the post-imperial global economy that set tariffs and trade regulations to benefit the wealthy and further impoverish the poor. We can't separate these things, but we can and we should accept the more general principle that over a long period and in complex ways, the West took much more from the rest of the world than it gave back, and that it is now time to give back what was taken. Rather than attempt to compensate only the descendants of slaves, I would urge this House instead to commit itself to seek to eradicate poverty throughout the world, not just in those nations that experience the effects of slavery, but throughout the whole world. You know, we already have a framework for beginning this task. In 2001, the United Nations adopted the Millennium Development Goals, 8 goals for the year 2015, which include halving the proportion of people whose income is less than a dollar a day, ensuring that children everywhere, boys and girls alike, will be able to complete a full course of primary school education, and halving, not even eradicating, halving the proportion of people without sustainable access to safe drinking water and basic sanitation. Now, I think it's fair to say that progress in meeting even these relatively modest goals has been patchy at best. There have been some successes, such as the dropping of the debt for some of the world's poorest nations. But even if all of the Millennium Goals were actually to be met by 2015, which is very unlikely, they would still only have tackled the most extreme forms of poverty. Much, much more needs to be done. And Western nations need to accept that a significant proportion of their domestic product needs to be devoted not just to the eradication of extreme poverty, but to the eradication of all poverty. Let's not attempt the impossible task of singling out the descendants of slaves for compensation. Instead, if the West is really to atone for the sins of empire, then the West should commit itself, we should commit ourselves, and I mean genuinely commit ourselves with cash up front to a future where no one is enslaved by poverty, illiteracy, and preventable disease.
I'd like to thank Dr. Brecken Gary for his fine speech. And we move now to the summary speeches. And in the quirk of the system we use here at UCL, Union Debating Society, we have a summary speech from the opposition side first, and that will be delivered by Fernbrook. Just as a reminder, these are 5-minute speeches and there are no points of information. There'll be one knock at 4 minutes to remind the speaker there's a minute left, but apart from that, there'll be no further interventions.
Okay, thank you. It's been a very interesting set of discussions coming both from the table and from the floor, and there are pros and cons obviously on both sides. I take the point being made now, and I wasn't clear about it in the past, that when talking about compensation, of course, lawyers think in terms of compensation, that we're not just talking about money. But I think, unfortunately, the majority of the public will think exactly that way, and that's something that needs to be addressed. One needs to explain to the public, who presumably want on your side, that we aren't just talking about money, we're talking about other things. Poverty is obviously very important, and in terms of the Millennium Development Goals, we need to find strategies to address poverty. There isn't one way of addressing poverty, there are a number. But it's important not to ignore the past. What I'm talking about, and I think what we're talking about, is the current legacy. We're not simply talking about a lot of people feeling guilty about what happened in the past, but it has relevance for the current situation that a number of people find themselves in today. One strategy, I think, is to look at the international trading regime. It was trade that generated the slave trade right in the beginning. If you read stuff coming out of people like Eric Williams, who's long since passed, but if you read his book, he makes it quite clear that racism was what was generated from chattel slavery. That legacy has not disappeared. We need to look at the inequitable trading rules that exist now in the Caribbean and also in Africa. And when we have the European Union, for example, agreeing with the World Trade Organization that it was awful that we had preferences, and yes, we agree that we should demolish the trading regime that gave preferential treatment to the Caribbean, there is a problem, because what's being put in place now, or they're trying to put in place, are these economic partnership agreements. But those economic partnership agreements assume that they have equal partners, and they clearly do not. One asks the question, well, why isn't the Caribbean, why aren't African states equal? Is there something inherently wrong with them, or is there something about their past that they aren't able to shift? My argument is that past is to do with the slave trade, and also to do with colonialism, and also to do with imperialism. And unless you have something else within that discussion, something that actually determines how those agreements are reached, we are not ever going to get past this debate and past this kind of discussion. It's good that we're having this discussion, because I think 10 years ago this would never have happened. It's good that we're actually raising consciousness, but it also need practical mechanisms for dealing with what's happened in the past. My view is one mechanism is to adopt a reparations framework that will address trading rules. It will enable people in those countries that are suffering to determine for themselves how they want to develop, not adopt a blueprint from somewhere else, because I just don't think that's going to work either. And, you know, I hope that this discussion will continue. I'm sure it will.
I'd like to thank Fern for her speech. And to conclude the case for the proposition, and indeed the debate as a whole, I'd like to ask Esther Stanford to sum up.
In summing up, I'd really like to begin with that famous saying, who feels it, know it. Esther Stanford is the name that I carry. Why do you think I have the name Stanford? Stanford is not an African name. It is an English name. That is a direct legacy of enslavement that many of us descendants of the enslaved carry. A loss of our language, our culture, our sense of identity and belonging. All of you must live in areas where you must be hearing about the rising anarchy in black communities. Youth who do not know who they are have no stake in society. This is a legacy which is yours and mine. Because if we refuse to ignore it, then you will feel the consequences of this dispossession. The whole question of everyone benefited. We're not talking about guilt. We're talking about responsibility. And we're talking about a call for us to rediscover our collective humanity. Because each time you deny our just claim to compensation, which is not just about money, then you deny our humanity just as your forefathers and your foremothers did. What are we talking about as the basis for compensation? We're talking about a still ongoing, not slave trade, but African holocaust of enslavement called the Maangamizi or the Maafa. We're not talking about trade. How can we justify rape, pillage, invasion, conquest, torture, dispossession as trade? There is something wrong with our collective psyche if we continue to use language that disempowers rather than builds. Reparations does not have to be divisive. I began by saying what we are talking about in the movement is pan-African reparations for global justice. Yes, we want a world that is just and fair, not just for us, but for everyone. But as long as we continue to be affected, both you and I, whether it's through white supremacy or black inferiority, whether it's to do with the privilege that many of you have inherited, then we have no way of moving forward collectively as humanity. Someone mentioned the question about education and that many descendants of the enslaved are also benefiting. Really? Have you seen the school exclusion statistics? What kind of education do we receive in these Eurocentric institutions? Do we learn about the role of Africa prior to enslavement, or is our history reduced to being a footnote in the annals of European history and all other subjects of discipline? It is ironic that we are in an educational establishment, but yet so much miseducation among some of the brightest minds. This is a direct legacy of enslavement and colonialism, the world that we have collectively inherited. So education is something that we must challenge: academic racism, the fees of overseas students who are being penalized by paying 2-3 times more than home students. So no, we are not benefiting. What is the way forward? Clearly, we need to have further dialogue. We need to have a national dialogue on this question of enslavement and its legacies, not only on Africans, but also Europeans. Let's talk about that collective legacy. We are, in particular, the Rendezvous Victory, calling for a British all-party parliamentary commission for truth, justice and reconciliation. If it was good enough in South Africa, why can't we have that in Britain? Clearly, there is still a question of the facts. We still have to establish the facts, and before we can determine appropriate measures of compensation, we have to actually do a proper accounting on the basis of the facts. We need to revisit our national history as to who we believe we are in this nation, Britain. Also, we're talking about a refashioning of the principles of law. We're not saying that actually we didn't have law. Many of the standards of law that now are now being applied were unjust. Many of African nations and Caribbean nations were colonized. That means that we were prevented from actually determining the legal structures by which we would want this reparations claim to be adjudicated. The question of compensation must be determined by those who feel it most. We reserve the right to define for ourselves our destinies and to be able to shape the national discourse as well as the outcomes of what that reparation settlement would be. And so simply what we are urging is that you join with us. You know, for this national dialogue, there is more dialogue that needs to happen on this issue in terms of what we think that responsibility would be and how we would apportion that responsibility in a way that we can make this world not only better for us as the descendants, but also for the rest of humanity and tackle many of the continuing economic legacies and vestiges of enslavement and colonialism.
I'd like to thank Esther Hurst. Esther for her fine speech. And we move now to the vote. I remind you, you can speak in proposition of the motion if you agree with the arguments on that side, in opposition if you didn't agree with the proposition, or you can vote in abstention if you either have no opinion or were convinced by either side or thought both sides were equally good. So if you'd like to vote in proposition, would you please raise your hand? And if you'd like to vote in opposition. And if you'd like to vote in abstention. Okay, while Stanzi adds those up for me, I'd like, first of all, to thank all our speakers tonight for coming, Professor Robin Blackburn, Annette Stanford, Dr. Brick and Carey, and Fern Bricken, for their fine speeches. I'd like to show our appreciation for them now. Before we announce the results of both the Floor Prize and the vote, next week we're in here again. We have a great lineup of speakers for this house would no longer fund homeopathic treatments on the NHS, including Simon Singh, who you may remember from his numerous television appearances or the book Fermat's Last Theorem. We have Professor David Colquhoun from UCL, who was embroiled in a bit of a controversy about the subject. Peter Fisher from the Royal London Homeopathic Hospital, and one more that we're just waiting for confirmation before we announce. It's going to be a great debate. We're in here. Then the week after, we're in the Haldane Room in the main UCL building for the American election debate. But before we move to the Marlborough Arms, the floor prize, I thought tonight we had, although we didn't have as many as we normally do, I thought we had a great range of speeches. I couldn't really, I will admit, decide who to give the prize to. So I'm going to do a bit of a cop-out. He didn't make the longest speech, but I thought he cleared up a lot of the issues, and he deserves a bit of a reward for doing so well at the weekend. I'd like to award the box jumpers to James Clay. So, the results of the debate. It is the first time in my memory that this has happened. In my 3 years at the Debating Society. In last place, unfortunately, although I think they did do very well, we have Proposition with 6 votes. In second place, we have Opposition with 35 votes. But in first place, and I think this is testament to the strength of the speeches on both sides, we have abstention with 37 votes. Thank you again to all our speakers and to all of you for coming.